Welcome to Ruby Ray, real and raw conversations for the rising global woman. I am your host, Jacqueline Norton. Hello, welcome back to episode 15 of the Ruby Ray podcast. I'm your host, Jacqueline Norton, and I'm so happy you're here today. I'm super excited for this conversation with Jamia Wilson. So Jamia is a movement builder, a feminist activist, writer, and speaker, and author, and she's also the executive director of the Feminist Press. And Jamia also has a special place in this podcast in the beginning of it, because it was at an event that I saw her speak at, and she spoke about slaying our fears. And if you ever have the chance to see her speak, just go, because it will light a fire in you. And she talks about how we self-sabotage and face resistance and really give up on the little whispers inside of us. And she said that, so why do we need external validation to prove something that I know is true inside of myself? And she asked us about the different whispers that we were silencing. And this podcast was a whisper that I was totally silencing. And I went up to her after and I told her about it, and she was like, well, when's your birthday? And it's in May, and I think this was in like March or April, and she's like, just launch on your birthday. And I did, and it's so cool to see this come full circle now and have her on the show and to birth the creation into the world. So this is your invitation for whatever little whisper that you have had in your mind for some time now, I'm sure, to follow it and to give it life and to give it time and devotion, because it's fun and it feels really good and it's the most true thing to you. So, but you know, beyond this, Jamia is a author of the children's books Young, Gifted, and Black, Step Into Your Power, along with most recently The ABCs of AOC, which was published just this past October. She's also the co-author of Roadmap for Revolutionaries, Resistance, Advocacy, and Activism for All, and she wrote the intro and oral history for Together We Rise, behind the scenes of the protest heard around the world. So that's the Women's March book. And she advocates for transformation and social justice, supporting the elevation of silenced and marginalized voices in her work, in all of her work, really across the board. It all ties back to this theme. And so today we talk about why showing up matters so much, especially in this time that we're living in, and how to put and why we need to be putting our privilege and our power to work every single day. We also talk about what it means to be accountable and discuss allyship, advocacy, and various forms of activism to inspire you to show up and act. And we also talk about deep listening and so much more. So I hope that you walk away with some real actionable steps and inspiration for what you can do, how you can contribute to this time that we are living through. I know that in our current political climate, it can feel very intense and disheartening at times, but that's never a reason to not show up and to not participate and to not contribute in the unique way that you can. And so in those times when you're feeling disillusioned, this is when I'm so grateful that we have people in this world right now, like Jamia, who remind us of the power of our voice, of the power of organizing and community and activism in whatever form it takes for you. And it's not so much what you do, it's the doing it that matters. And so without further ado, here is Jamia Wilson.
So I'd love to hear a little bit about your story. Did you always know that you wanted to work in feminist media and as a storyteller and activist? Or how did that evolve and where are you now?
Yes. So I always knew that I wanted to create books. That was always something I always knew I wanted to do. I always knew I wanted to do something in the world that would change people's lives to promote justice. And when I was always someone who cared about fairness a lot, above all else, in childhood, and then kind of grew to understand it as being more than fairness, but really caring about equality. And when I started to see more gender equality in plain sight and started to see and sharpen my ability to see covert and overt discrimination as it related to all sorts of identity, I really then started to self-identify as a feminist in my early tweens. And ever since then, I was just really moved to want to be involved in campus organizations, in writing for the school paper, in speaking truth to power, and making sure that I could use my voice to help improve the lives of people in my community, but also my own life. There was always a part of me that understood that my work would be very much connected to freedom for myself and freedom for others, but feeling very personally connected to being involved in that kind of movement work at a deep level and understanding that any work that I would do, I would come to it from that kind of lens and approach.
So now you're at Feminist Press. And so how are you evolving that mission into what you're currently doing now?
I love being at Feminist Press, especially at this moment in Feminist Press's life and also in this chapter in my life. Feminist Press has been around for 49 years. Next year will be our 50th birthday. And so I'm now working at an organization that's been around longer than I've been alive. And I feel lucky to have been a part of the world in a world where there's always been a feminist press, where there's always been a focus on a mission that is about advancing and amplifying feminist perspectives through storytelling. And it's extremely important to me to be a part of Feminist Press at this juncture because we are building on a really strong legacy that already existed that was about personal transformation and social justice and supporting the elevation of silenced and marginalized voices. But also, we're now doubling down on that for this particular moment, amplifying insurgent voices, deepening our commitment to amplifying the voices of the most marginalized people, but also really thinking about the ways in which we can invest in debut writers of color who are women or non-binary people and making sure that we are also a part of changing the pipeline in the publishing industry so that it is more reflective of the full diversity of our community. And right now, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make publishing look as diverse as the subways look, look as diverse as what we see in our communities around us. And that's what I want to see in the industry that I work in.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, we're in this crazy time where we see female leaders of color being told by our president to go back to their country. We're seeing in the media women stories about women equating to about 10% of the stories being told and quality issues with the women's soccer team with equal pay. We're also seeing feminist media outlets that are unable to meet their fundraising goals or going out of business. So we're in this time where there's a lot changing and there is a lot evolving in this space where on one hand we are threatened with Roe v. Wade and legislation almost moving backwards. And then on the other hand, we have more women running for president than ever before and women in Congress and this huge push forward. So I'm curious what you think the future of feminist media is in this time of transition.
Yeah, so right now, you know, it is a really, really intense time. And, you know, I personally believe that oftentimes when you're in a zeitgeist like we are right now, things get a lot messier before they get better. And I think that that's something I remind myself when I feel like I'm in the throes of a big tsunami wave of this moment that we're in. And so, yes, you know, we are in a time right now that is hostile to the amplification of diverse insurgent feminist voices to the equality of diverse people. And we are seeing the clutches of an old system that no longer works, really trying to maintain its dominance, really trying to use power and abuse power in order to maintain its power and maintain its unearned privilege. And so that for us makes rough waters ahead. And we see that in economics and we see that in culture. But what we have to understand is that it's important to stay the course, that things like backlash happen because opponents to change and justice just know how powerful we are. They understand that we are going toward the course of history, that as Martin Luther King said, that the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice. So we just have to keep moving forward. We have to continue to forge forward. We have to continue to see through our vision and understand that the resilience that we're gaining right now is what we were born to have, to see through the goals for the better present and future that we hope for ourselves, but also for the next generation. And that's why I believe Feminist Press has been able to survive for 50 years, being born of a cultural zeitgeist moment and still being here during one of the biggest ones of my lifetime, and why we will continue to persist. And it's just something that I think about a lot, that I feel fortunate to be alive during this time, that I was alive during better times, but I feel like now I'm alive during a time when I can be most useful to fighting for the things I care about and to maintain and to advance the values that I believe that we all deserve, but also that the next generation deserves. And so, yes, not always going to be easy, but the fundamental core things that hold us all together, like joy and community and partnership and shared power, those things are stronger than the necessity that we're fighting right now.
Right. And so it's easy to get caught up in this snowstorm of it all, because we're constantly our 24/7 news media culture. Sometimes it's hard to take a step back and see the larger picture of what's really happening here. So what would you say would be some of the lessons of this moment?
I think the lesson is that showing up matters. You know, we hear a lot about young people and how young people need to do more. And, you know, there's all these things about so-called apathy from young people. But let's think about all the young people who have been driving change in the climate movement around the world, driving change in the peace movement. We have Greta, we have Malala, we have the record-breaking Women's March that is the largest march in recorded history around the world. And a large part of that work came from younger people and people who came together to make change because they understood that showing up was one thing that we could do in a moment when it seemed like everything that we knew and understood was being taken away. And so I think that that's the lesson that I've gotten for me, the power of showing up, power of community, the power of resilience, the power of getting up. My late mother had said when the election happened, and I was so upset, as were so many people, she just said, you know, you have 24 hours to kind of like deal with your feels about this. And then tomorrow you're going to have to get on up and do the work like we did. And I thought that was really important and integral for me that, you know, the day after I had a day and then I flew out to Denver to do some activist work immediately and to support work about getting investment in Indigenous communities around ending online harassment and abuse. And doing that work kind of reminded me the lesson of the moment that, you know, I have a choice in this moment to decide what my actions are going to be, no matter what's kind of happening around me. And it doesn't make what's happening okay. It doesn't cede accountability for the atrocities that are happening. But there is this driving force that I at least have as the big lesson for me, which is that there's always a choice that I can make. There is always a righteous decision that can be made, one from a place of determination and one from a place of like self and community actualization in the face of abuse and power that's being abused. So I think that's the big lesson. I think also this is a moment of accountability. It's sort of a reckoning. And we've seen this with Me Too. We're seeing this climate change. I think the nature's kind of reckoning with us and how we've treated Mother Earth right now with all the things that we're seeing. And the lesson in that,
I would say nature and women.
Yes, nature and women, right? Like life givers. That the people who know how to listen, and I don't mean listening just with ears, but like empaths, like people who are healers, people who, like, what is needed to transform where we we are right now is bigger than sort of the usual tried and true pragmatics tool. We need everyone and we need everybody's gifts to get us out of this mess. And that's why I'm also really interested in kind of the honing in of deep listening and deep noticing and deep sensitivity to what is happening around us. What are we feeling? What are we experiencing? And taking note and being present and showing up for ourselves, but also for each other.
I think that's a huge point that you brought up, just this idea of full listening, being fully engaged and present in whatever you're doing. So I'd love for you to go into that a little bit more of what that can look like for us, because let's be honest, like that is a challenge for a lot of society, us as a whole, as the microcosm, you know, I guess the macrocosm and the microcosm, both on a collective and individual level with technology and distraction. And kind of that feeling of being pulled a million different directions. So any advice that you have in bringing that full listening to what you're doing?
You know, I think when I think of myself and what the struggles I have, it's, you know, I am trying now to forgive myself when I become distracted from that listening and to be more kind to myself and acknowledging that it would make sense that in the tumult of everything that one would feel that and one might be distracted or one might not always feel like we're functioning in terms of our highest self, and then to say, I'm human and tomorrow I can try again, or in this next moment I can take a deep breath and try again, and that's always there as long as we're here. And I think that's most important, to understand that we're not perfect and that we always have the ability to make a different choice and the ability to show up in the way that is the highest for us and for others. And that's something that I'm really trying to do with that listening, to say, oh, sometimes I'm not taking my own advice. Sometimes I will have visceral reactions out of fear and pain and past struggle and conditioning. And then I'll have to say, okay, maybe I'm feeling embarrassed about how I behaved, or maybe I'm feeling embarrassed about something I didn't know or my own ignorance. And maybe I have the choice to acknowledge that, to tend to it, to say, okay, you aren't the first human and nor will you be the last who will have this feeling, but the moment warrants you to heal now and try again and to do better. And that has really helped me in my own process to say, okay, yeah, this is where I am right now. It doesn't mean it's where I always have to be.
Right. That forgiveness, self-forgiveness. So you talk about showing up, and we have these, for example, the Women's March and kind of these different large events that go on in symbolic times. But what does show some, for example, like, you know, after Trump was elected, things like that. But what does showing up mean on a more everyday basis? You know, I had a friend recently, we were talking and she was just like, I need to get more involved. Like, I need to figure out what it is to do, like, kind of beyond the finger activism. And so what does showing up mean to you? What are maybe perhaps some overlooked ways we can be getting more involved and accountable for being involved in this time?
So one thing I'd love to share is that my friends Carolyn Juran and Elisa Kamahort Page and I, we wrote a book called Roadmap for Revolutionaries. And that book is a book that we wrote in response to that very question that you're asking. We really understood that after the election happened, many people in our lives were saying, help, I'm scared, or I'm overwhelmed. There's so much that needs to be done. It feels too big. What are we going to do? How are we going to do it? Maybe I'm not going to do anything because I can't do everything. And we decided that what we felt like we were going to do was to create a book, a field guide, sort of like a scout handbook for how each person could figure out how to take action, be it through activism, through advocacy, social justice, making your voice heard, how you could hit the ground running with practical tactics, how you could protect democracy, but also sort of your own personal democracy in a volatile environment, and how you could make a difference. So we talk about the basics, and we talk about the local, state, federal governments, and we talk about protests, and we talk about things like that. But we also talk about, how do you start your own media platform? How do you manage your online privacy? How do you get health care when you need it and you're a non-binary person or a trans person who needs to get access to reproductive health care? How do you get contraception and access to reproductive health care in a state or community that is becoming increasingly hostile to that sort of care? All of those things are things we talk about. How do you, if you are someone like a doctor who wants to help support at Standing Rock, give back to the community in that way? And so we show that by an interview that we had with a doctor who went to Standing Rock and helped people with care. We talk about that in terms of healthcare. We talk about that in terms of interviewing people like Tavi Jevonson and like Patrice Cullors and like Amber Goodwin, who were all people who took action in their community. Amber Goodwin decided to start an organization to fight against gun violence, but specifically about how gun violence is affecting communities of color, which isn't as much the conversation that the media is focused on. Although gun violence is very much an important issue and impacting communities of color. So that is what we did as our contribution. And that what I learned from that is that we really saw that everyone doesn't have to do everything super well, that you can kind of triage the issues and triage the strengths that you have to do the most in the spaces where you can be most effective. And you can help and support in different ways the movements that other people might be most effective in leading. And we talk about that as well in the book, about how to be an ally so that we don't have to feel like we are also leading everything, right? That we can help support the people who are leading it and how we can be more helpful and less harmful to other movements, how we can be acknowledging of powerful, of improper and unbalanced power dynamics, and how we can transform those and acknowledge when we've caused harm and move forward from a place of community. And so all of those things we cover in the book. And it's something I'm really proud of because we exemplified that as a community writing the book, three people who are in different places around the country in different backgrounds. But then also we really give people tangible ideas about what it is they can do no matter what their interests are, what their political leanings are, etc. And we have links to all sorts of other organizations and businesses, etc., that people can tap into.
Amazing. That's like the most comprehensive roadmap to this question.
Thank you. Thank you. I love the question because I thought, oh my gosh, I can't wait to see what she thinks of the book, because it really is, just even in terms of researching that book and all of us working on it and reading my colleagues' contributions to the book as well, really helped me feel stronger. And it didn't mean that politically things weren't still hot, right? Or that culturally things weren't still happening that were deeply concerning. But I felt more empowered having more knowledge about how to respond in this moment from an informed place and an empowered place, and felt more empowered knowing others will have that through this book.
Yeah. And I'm sure like just reading it will spark creativity and different ideas as far as things that we didn't even think about that could probably be really effective when put into action that are totally overlooked as well.
Thank you.
So you talk about being an ally, and what, you know, this is it, what I guess what I'm saying is, how, what do you think it means to be a good ally? We're in a time where this oppression is internalized within us, and we're seeing the rise of different hate crimes, and we're seeing white feminism and white supremacy, and, you know, 53% of white women voted for Trump. And so there's this desire to move things forward, and especially like as women, knowing our rights and knowing our power and progressing things. But then there's also these realities. And so do you have any advice or insight into how can we, and like myself speaking, how can I as a white woman be showing up and being a good ally to the best of my ability?
So it's really funny that we're talking about that question next, because that is something that I did write about in Roadmap for Revolutionaries. And it came from a piece that I wrote when I was writing for Rookie Magazine in around 2015. And I wrote it because during that time, there was a big Black Lives Matter protest that happened in Oakland, California, when I was living there. And it was really inspiring to me, despite the things that were happening related to state violence and feeling as a woman of color and a Black woman very much in despair about what was happening around me, to see that at my acupuncturist, Black Lives Matter was on the poster in Oakland and Berkeley, where I was living, that where I went to grocery shop, Black Lives Matter was on their posters, where I went to go to eat at certain restaurants, my coffee shop, and even the place I would go to get my herbs, I would go to get like herbal supplements and things like that, an apothecary, and they had a Black Lives Matter sign. And I thought, wow, these people in my community know the power of what it means, the platform that they have, what it means to make a statement to their community and to their customers, that they support and affirm and believe in the protection of humanity for all people. And they're willing to make that statement, even if there are people who might disagree with them or might not patronize their businesses anymore. And that is real solidarity. And so it moved me to write this piece about what does it mean to be an ally. And at the time, I'd been thinking about a conversation I'd had with a close friend who had said, look, I really want to be an ally, but I don't know what to do because it just seems so big. I don't know where to start. What do you want me to do as a white person? I can't stop these police. I can't stop these politicians, etc. And I said, well, you actually do have a lot of power. And it's really actually offensive that because you feel overwhelmed by it, that you would feel like you have to do nothing, because so many other choices you could be making in the in-between of that. And that would be recognizing your own power and owning your privilege rather than pretending like it's not there. So the tips I give in it are several main tips, which I can just kind of briefly outline, which is one, to kind of say that before anyone can be an ally, they've got to own and understand their privilege and their relationship to power. And if you have an identity that's normalized or centered within the dominant culture, that's privilege. And I always like to say for people who want to understand more deeply what that means, that as a woman of color, I experienced sexism, I experienced racism, but I'm also middle class. I grew up mostly able-bodied. I'm an American citizen with an American passport, and I'm straight, and I'm cisgender. So that also comes with a lot of significant privilege and impacts the way I'm treated and what opportunities I have and what access I have and what access other people don't have. And I think it's really important to own our privilege first and foremost. Two, we talked about vulnerability, you know, just making sure that we understand that we can and will make mistakes and not let our fear of making mistakes and being held accountable for them get in the way of us doing the right thing. Because we can always apologize, and it's always important to apologize when necessary and to make amends and to do what's right to fix things when we do cause harm. I also think listening, which, you know, I'm a fan of, I think is important to just really listen and listen to the communities who are closest to the issues and the problems that we're trying to resolve about what those solutions are. Those are always the communities who are going to know what the best solutions are for their communities. And it's important to listen and ask how we can be of help versus kind of trying to prescribe what the best thing is from our range of vision.
Right, going in with the solution.
Exactly, because then when it's us trying to be saviors for others, it's really about us and our own egos and not about actually making the change. Then it's also just important to know that it's about community. So find your community, find other people who want to work with you to make this change, who want to partner together, who want to share resources. And the community is one of the most beautiful parts of being an ally. Next, it's just important to kind of face our fears and show up anyway. That, no, it's not going to always be easy, but the work is still worth it. Also, do your homework. So it's really important that if you're going to join a movement, you need to understand the history. You need to understand the communities and to stay up to date on current perspectives, and then also understand what movements might have been thinking through, because that way you can be more effective and also more supportive and intentional. It's also really important to give credit, and that's a big part of the doing our homework part, because sometimes people will think they might have invented something, but at the end of the day, chances are there was likely a lot of other smart human beings who thought about it or thought about something similar too. So it's also really important to give that credit and to show respect for the people who came before us. And then also to be mindful that we're not using damaging or hurtful or harmful language that we might not know is harmful, but it still doesn't make it okay to do. So it's important for us to also make sure that we kind of understand the language that we're using, understand that the words matter, and also that we are doing the work to ensure that we are also able to create more inclusive space and community for people who we're working in partnership with and co-creating movements.
It's really about, I feel like, putting these into action on like a step-by-step basis, right? So it doesn't get totally like that, I guess, that overwhelm of like needing to, feeling the need to do it all at once.
Yeah. And that's a thing, you know, we don't have to do it all at once, but we have to do it like with intention and with integrity, right? And so I think that's a thing I always remind myself is sometimes we are in the society we're in right now, you know, it's so focused on production and consumption and do, and do it quickly. And everything has to happen in a specific way. But actually, a lot of times the solutions lie in the opposite reaction of our conditioning, right? That it's kind of like, oh, are we really intentional and thoughtful and listening deeply and holding this with nuance and care? Like, that's where the magic actually can happen.
Ooh, I love that. Yeah, and like the depth and the learning. So I want to keep moving on here, and I'd love to just do like a little feminism 101 quick training, just sort of the basics of what this means for someone who maybe is looking to get involved or use their voice in some way, or just be a part of the conversation, but perhaps they didn't have like strong female modeling that they grew up with, or feel like it's either like you're this bra-burning, like, you know, like outrageous feminist, or you're like a Trump supporter, and where are you? That there, it's like kind of either one, these very vast differences. So I guess, first of all, how would you define a feminist?
So I really like the dictionary definition, which I know probably sounds really boring, but I really like that a feminist is a person who believes in the political, social, economic, cultural, and I also like to say cultural and also personal equality of people of all genders, all races, all classes. In my mind, that a person who believes in full equality for all people is a feminist. Feminism is about equality for all people.
And what do you think are some of the main challenges facing feminism today?
Oh, I think, you know, like any movements we're having right now, we have these reckonings that we're talking about, that all these things are kind of coming up to the surface. And, you know, any abuses of power or imbalancings of power are now being faced and being brought forth for us to have to witness and confront them. And feminism has, like any other social movement that's operated in historically and presently within systems where white supremacy and misogyny have been present, has also had to grapple with the clutches of those systems within our own movements. And so I think that although we have more awareness about intersectional feminism and more inclusive feminism that shows the complexity and the diversity of all people, we still have a lot of work to do that is not all that dissimilar from what our foremothers had to grapple with as well, around ensuring that the movements that we are driving are inclusive, that they are recognizing the needs of all the people in our community, and that we're uplifting the most marginalized. And I think, you know, we also need to really talk about issues like disability, trans issues, immigration, also the rights of women who are sex workers, et cetera, and non-binary people who are sex workers, people whose stories have been silenced or marginalized or pushed to the margins. Those are most important to be uplifted, because when we achieve the freedom of the people who are most marginalized, then that means that all of us will be free.
Yes.
So I often say, when we are, you know, I had a cousin of mine who I disagree with on a great many things, was very upset by something I had posted about Syrian refugees, and said that I cared more about children in Syria than I cared about children in the US. And why was I focusing my efforts on that when we had enough problems in our own community? And I was just saying, wow, you know, an attitude like that was something that people were using locally to talk about Black children, or could be still using that in this context. But also, when Syrian refugees are free, that creates more of a world for that, creates a series of conditions that would also help me be more free, right? I think it's really important for us to think about that you may feel free, you may feel safe, but as long as there is one person living in unliberated ways with the abundance that we have in society, and it not being fairly apportioned to all of us, then none of us are free. The Handmaid's Tale, I was just watching this week's, and one of the most important parts here, and I promise it's not a spoiler, just really about saying something to one of the men who was in the power position, sort of abusing his power, and June, who's the protagonist of the show, saying, "Oh, wow, now you know what it feels like when they're eventually coming for you, but you never thought they would come for you." And I think that's something I often think about as well, that it's important for us to all assume that the work that we're doing to help make the world better for all people is inherently about making the world better for all people, but also for ourselves, that we understand that no one of us deserves any more than any of us do, that it's about creating a world where all of us can thrive. And that's the worldview that I hold.
Yeah. And, you know, it made me think about some of the most vulnerable. And I remember reading about like trans women of color, some of the most marginalized, and how in Pride Month, I think there were 3 murders alone within that community, or if not more. And what do you think it's a matter of when it comes to lending support and using, putting our privilege to work for these people who are really at risk of like even just leaving their house? How can we best participate or be involved in supporting them? Do you think it comes down to educating, like education and just understanding the complexities of the issues, or anything else?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, education. I think being an ally, standing up, using our voices to support, supporting organizations who are expert in this work. So, you know, donating is extremely important. If you feel like, oh, I don't know if I have this expertise, but I want to support, you know, going to organizations that are doing the work and supporting them. Even if you only have $1 to give, $5 to give, those dollars add up with other people's dollars. And those can really do a lot to change people's lives. And so, you know, I think if, and specifically you're talking about trans people and just this terrible tragedy that we have where trans women of color specifically are targeted and are being murdered in just disproportional rates compared to others. And it's horrible. It's important for us to kind of support the organizations who are doing this work and are also doing work that is very informed and who have the programs and capacity to help support communities in the ways that they need. And so I would definitely say that the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, supporting them and their work, I think is extremely important. They work to ensure that all people are free to self-determine gender identity and expression, regardless of their race. And they do amazing work. So I think supporting them would be really important. Supporting organizations like GLAAD, who promote LGBTQ equality and do great media monitoring work and really focus at the intersection of culture. Lambda Legal, who does amazing legal work in this space. American Civil Liberties Union is always a great place to support because they are always on the front lines of legal work as well, and also have a big historic legacy in doing this work and doing that well as well. And I also think, you know, supporting organizations like the Audre Lorde Project, who rate community-based organizing work and nonviolent activism and have really radical programs as well. And we can support those organizations as volunteers. We can support those organizations as donors. We can support those organizations by supporting organizations like the Third Wave Fund and supporting them in funding those organizations.
And what do they do, the Third Wave Fund?
So the Third Wave Fund is an amazing organization that has really funded some of the most cutting edge work supporting young women of color, queer movements, and young people's activism and young people's vision for activist change. And they've been doing this for about 20 years, I believe. And they mainly support activist work that's led by people under 35 years old. And it's amazing. They provide really important tools and support for this work and support the organizations that are really, really close to the communities that need the help the most. And so they have a really great Mobilize Power Fund. They have a sex worker giving circle. There's an Owning Our Power Fund, and all of that you can find on their website. But I would definitely say that that would be a really great place to invest and to support if someone wanted to take their work to a place of urgency, but also know that it would be used in a really important grassroots way.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much. That's super helpful. And I'll link these websites and organizations in the show notes, because I know sometimes there's that question of how do we know what's a vetted organization, or that we know our dollars are really going to support the people that we want and causes that we want to be supporting. So that's super helpful.
Thank you.
I'd love to get a three steps to feminist activism, or like five steps if you have it, for someone who's like never gotten involved before, but they're feeling like, I can't just continue sitting on my couch yelling at the TV during this time when all of this stuff is going on. And I know you kind of like went through some of it before, but is there anything like baby steps that you found were really effective and perhaps aren't being talked about in this space?
So I would say, one, speak up. So if you were waiting for the time to know when it was your turn to get permission to speak, now is the time. I would say next time you hear a sexist joke, or you hear a sexist and racist joke, or next time you see a woman is being interrupted at work, speak up and say, hey, or if a woman not being given credit for what she did at work, say, oh, you know, actually, Steve, Sarah said that, or Ezra said. You know, I think that some of those ways that we can, I always kind of like call them the mini insurrections, that just speaking up, naming the problem, naming the injustice is very powerful.
It is. And to trust your intuition in that, because so often I think as women, we have that gut feeling of this is wrong, but we might be in a room where we're the only ones and it feels like speaking truth to power, and to give ourselves that, our own power to do that, to say that.
That I 100% agree. And I also think just, you know, making sure to lift as we climb, you know, helping to support each other. There's enough room for all of us to thrive. When you take a step up, take someone with you, and always be thinking of that. And how can you mentor others? How can you give back? That's the way of the universe, the reciprocity, the circle, right? Like when you receive, you should also give, right? And it should also go back and forth. It's not just about taking. And I think that's really important as well. We've been taught to compete, but what's more powerful is collaboration. And doing that is extremely important. Building community, supporting each other, and helping to partner. We're stronger together than we are apart. And then I think getting involved in organization, being a volunteering at your local rape crisis center, volunteering at your local domestic violence shelter, volunteering on a women's campaign, volunteering for any other nonprofit that you care about that does feminist work. Also joining a board, or joining a youth board, or donating, or if you have a specific expertise that you can offer, asking if you can offer that. All those kinds of things could be extremely important and can help do the work. I think buying feminist books, as a feminist press director, I'd be remiss in saying that. You know, buy directly from feminist booksellers and independent bookstores who sell your favorite books by women. Buy from the feminist press and buy from us directly. Buy books for yourself and your friends. So when you get a book that has taught you something and has helped you see a new thing in the world and a new perspective, buy a copy for a young woman in your life, or a young girl in your life, or for a boy who needs to learn about gender equality too. I think that is extremely important. And then that's a really important part of making sure that the next generation is also supported and getting that education as well. And then I also think just knowing your rights, you know, just really being up to date on what the issues are and what power you do have, and how to take action, and sharing that with others, organizing an event in your community, and just also not being afraid to say you're a feminist, I think is also powerful.
Okay, can we talk about that? Because I feel like a lot of people are afraid to, because of the stigma that's attached to it. So what do you have to say about this, about someone who is afraid to just say, I believe in the equality of women, or I'm a feminist? What's your take on that?
So Maya Angelou had a quote about feminism where she said, and she had so many good ones, but she said I'm a feminist. I've been a female for a long time now. I'd be stupid not to be on my own side. And then she said, each time a woman stands up for herself, she stands up for all women. And so I love that. And I love Mother Maya. Maya Angelou taught me so much. I really wish I had been able to meet her while she was alive. But I feel like I've met her through her words. And just feminism makes sense. It is about equality. It has been stigmatized because the people are benefiting from patriarchy and the abuse and imbalance of power don't want us to realize that equality is better for all of us. Feminism actually benefits men because it allows them to be the full spectrum of what it means to be a human being versus confining them to only one way of being in toxic masculinity. So I believe that Mother Maya's wisdom about being on our own side is about being on all sides, really. That being a feminist is about creating balance and equality and a sense of order where everybody's needs are met and everybody is supported. And I think that most people would agree with that.
Yeah, yeah. She put it really simply and to the point, as she does so well. So you talk about a little bit, and I don't know if you want to touch on this, but I'm curious if you have anything to say about involving men in the conversation, because I think that this is one area where it's been talked about and it's being talked about very much amongst women, and sort of it's going from like the conversations are going from whispers that you used to like kind of say under your breath about maybe something that happened to you or something you're upset about to like these more, it's getting louder and louder. And, you know, I'm not a man, so I don't know what the conversations are being had amongst men are. But as far as what we can do to include men in this process, because I don't think it should be this divisive thing where it's like women against men thing. It's like, no, we need to include them in the conversation and uplift them as well so that they can grow and progress, and not in a toxic sense, but just so we can all evolve.
Yeah, I think it's really about, you know, inviting men to participate in the movement. I think it's really important for men to also be the people who are getting these conversations asked of them. So one of the things I like to do is kind of gift feminist books to men in my life, or invite them to feminist events, or to talk to them about the issues, though, to show them, oh, these issues actually matter to you too. You know, I often love to talk with my husband, who goes to many feminist events because by Lou being with me and Lou and all of that, to say, oh, you know, did you know that parental leave, fighting for that is actually really helpful to you, because that would mean you would have time, if we were to have a child, also bond with that child, but also to help share the labor of what it means to walk out into your family. And so a lot of times too, it's about helping them understand how feminism and the policies that are related to it help all of us, and also create a world where we can all thrive more, and to share with them the books that you're reading that have been illuminating things to you, and invite them to events, to ask them to partner with you on educating their community. So my husband does a benefit event with me every year where he curates a jazz event, because he's a jazz musician, for the feminist press. And he works to help curate a feminist jazz event where majority of the musicians are women at the helms of these bands. And he and some of the other men who participate support the event as sidemen, but they're not the focal point. But the money toward benefiting feminist publishing, but it also showcases women in jazz, which is an industry that has been mostly male dominated for a long time. So that is a really great example of how we can partner together and help support each other's work, but also show in our collaboration together, men and women teaming up to amplify gender equality. And those are the kinds of things that anyone can do kind of by combining their strengths and combining their network and access to community to raise awareness and to take action.
I love that. And making it fun too, like in music. Yeah. So is there anything else that you wanted to add to that? I know that we kind of left off with organizing the community as far as like actionable steps. Are there any specific ways or your favorite events or ways to organize community, maybe at more of a grassroots level?
Yes. Yeah, you know, over the years, I've participated in so many different actions, and I'm always really amazed by how the community comes up with amazing new ways to engage. And so I always want to just say, listen deeply and think about what your community needs, or what they can benefit from, or what they can heal with. What can bring joy to your community? My friends started the Resistance Revival Chorus.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I love them. Oh my gosh. It brings me so much joy to see them singing. It's like,
it's amazing. And it brings them so much joy. And I think that that and that came from them understanding that joy is something that is resistance in the midst of all of the things that we've been talking about now, but also it brings in community. It gives people hope. It inspires people to take action. And they've just done amazing things from, you know, the grassroots level to being at different literal active space and events for ending abortion bans or singing so that kids who are being detained by ICE can hear them, to them singing at the Grammys with Kesha. All of those things are building awareness about joy as a form of resistance, but also building awareness about the issues that they're singing about. And so I think that that's a really great example of how really it's about thinking about what does your community need right now? What could emerge that could bring people together? Because that will continue to shift and change over time. Or what are the things you already do in your community that people enjoy that could be done to bring people together? So for example, we do a drag queen story hour events that we partner with Drag Queen Story Hour and Feminist Press. We have drag queen bingo benefit at Feminist Press. We have had a hip hop workshop with our Crunk Feminist Collective book.
Yes.
Written by amazing scholars who are doing work at the intersection of hip hop feminism and academia, and had a DJ at that event, but we're also talking about scholarship and rigorous theory. And so I think it's about what is your community need? Is it that your community might need a spiritual event? The day before the Women's March, I participated in a beautiful service at a church where they had me, Marianne Williamson, my friend Morley, Carrie Kelly, Lisa Bloom, many different people on a panel talking about what we were going to do the next day from a sense of spirit and faith, and also to kind of put forth a blessing for that march. And that was something that was well attended. And a lot of the people from that event the next morning went and did yoga and meditation at the helm of the march as well, to hold intention and hold space. So wherever we are and whatever it is that brings us joy or community or that inspires us, that there are many different ways that we can have interventions and that we can make change. And many times it's just right in front of us what we can do and what we're capable of doing.
Cool. Yeah, I love that, and how it's like digging into the different flavor and just unique elements of where you live and building from that place versus having this one size fits all sort of solution to it.
And I think that's where the sweet spot is, right? Because sometimes when you're doing a political campaign, yes, you know, statistically, the best way to move hearts and minds of the voters is to knock door to door and do telephone calls, right? And that's important. And we should always still do those. But I remember in the last 2016 election, there were amazing things happening with text messages. And there was a text message dance party I saw they had done at the Hillary campaign that I just thought was amazing. I wasn't there, but I saw pictures of it on Instagram. And I thought, that is so cool. And it just made me feel excited to text to donate.
Totally.
The pictures.
Yeah. Well, and I heard recently that it's like the part of your brain, what is it? Like the part of your brain that decides on who you're going to vote for isn't the, like, it's more of the emotional side. So it's like doing things like that, that spark emotion in you versus like this very logistical political talk.
Was it the amygdala? Was that what they said? That was the part of your brain? That would be so funny.
I don't know. I can't remember, but it probably would be the amygdala. I'm like, amygdala hijack going on right now.
But I think it's true, because I think we're all sort of like, you know, I think people make a lot of judgments too about who people are leaning toward in these elections, right? I mean, I know I do when I hear who a person's top candidate is, and sometimes I'll be like, what? You know, yeah. But sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to do with a policy position, right? It has a feeling for people about like,
yeah,
what I think this person represents or who I think they represent. What they're giving off makes me feel this way or that way about like how I would relate to them, right? And so I do think that that's just really interesting, because I think that there is something about just like what it means to be human and our bias, explicit and implicit, and how that impacts us.
Yes. And I love what you said, even about the Women's March, how you had like a spiritual event before, because I love that, like the merging of spirituality and politics. And I feel like that is something that you don't really like mix the two ever. And that's actually something that for me is really refreshing about Marianne Williamson's platform, because she'll go there and she's not afraid to like look at the underlying issues like that cause these societal issues to happen, you know, and kind of like dig deep into them. And really bring like these different, it's for me, it's refreshing to listen to her because it isn't that like kind of typical political like back and forth banter. It's more of looking at the holistic overarching issues relating to it. So who knows if it's the success of it or how much it resonates, but in a way I feel like American people are at least in a place where we're open to having these conversations.
Yes, yes. And I think, and that one of my friends was saying, who, you know, is definitely not going to vote for her and is sort of like a political pragmatist, but she said, you know, that she really appreciated Marianne Williamson's clarity. Mm. And I thought, yeah, you know, she does have a kind of clarity that she's able to go there about, and that she's able to name certain things that need to be named, and that that's an important role that she's playing in this conversation.
It is. And you know what? She's a role model for women who are afraid to speak up, because I saw her on CNN last night and she had no problem standing her ground and being like, please, like, let me finish my sentence. And the anchor wasn't letting her just finish her train of thought. And she really kept on insisting on like, let me finish what I'm trying to say. As a society, we react to that by being like, oh, like she's being bitchy woman or something. And it's like, no, he was doing that. And it's true. And she wasn't afraid to call it for what it was. And it also goes to the point of news anchors. And it's like, what is our roles? What is your roles as a reporter in society? Is it to add your personal opinion to it? Or is it to simply state the objective facts and let the audience decide for themselves?
Yeah. And I think and the fact that she's even asserting that she deserves to speak, right? I think that's so important just to do that, right? That he's almost surprised that like, oh, if I shut you down, you should just be okay with me shutting you down. The society.
Totally. And that's the end of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Teaches them that, you know, if you would like not allow that, or you would deign to say, no, I actually deserve to speak, even though you're telling me that I don't, that could really tick certain people off. But that's their problem and not our problem.
You know what? Every time that I've spoken up towards an injustice or called out sexism as it's happening, and you know, a lot of times when this happens, let's be honest, it happens within our relationship. So that's where these sort of conversations, it's like your entryway into having, recognizing these things. And every time it's happened, or every time I've spoken up, it's been the response I've gotten from the men is sort of like, oh, like, and they're almost like grateful that I said it because they weren't seeing it. So it isn't always like this hard shutdown. You know, sometimes they're really appreciative of you raising their awareness to this happening.
Exactly. And sometimes and they need to hear it. They don't necessarily know because they haven't been taught to look for those things or to listen for those things.
Right. So I want to know, when it comes to the election, are you looking to vote specifically for a woman, or is it more about policy for you coming from this feminist media place? What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, I'm in a point of just sort of really like listening to everyone who's running, and there are people of all genders who are uplifting ideas that I care about. But what I do think is that we have had, for as long as this nation has been a nation, only one gender running this country, and it's time for a change. And obviously we've seen that they have not fixed everything with the status quo. And so I'd like to see some new leadership. And so I'm very interested in the women who are running. And in the last election, I supported the women who was running and the women who were running and then the women who was running in the end. At this point, there are women who are running who I think would be phenomenal at their jobs and would be able to take our country and really transform things. I do not think that all of the women who are running, based on who is running now, represent policies or viewpoints that necessarily represent the best and overall good for all women. But I think that most of the women who are running do.
Do you think a woman can run and defeat Trump in this election?
You know, I do. And the reason I say that is because a lot of people said that Barack Obama could never win because he was the first African-American president, and he won. And so I believe that there always has to be a first. And I do believe that we have the numbers and we have the base to make that happen. But obviously there's some steep challenges ahead, and we've seen that before. And we also know that due to voter suppression and gerrymandering and all of those other things, that it's going to have to be really, really important for all the people who do want change to turn out and make sure that they help turn out the people in their communities who didn't show up last time.
Totally. Collective effort.
Yes.
Okay, well, I want to do a couple rapid-fire questions before we wrap up.
Sure.
All right, so what is your favorite feminist book?
I love so many.
Is there a particular one that changed your life?
Ooh, there's so many. I think I Love Myself When I'm Laughing, which is by Zora Neale Hurston, and the Feminist Press is doing a 50th edition of that next year.
What is your favorite act of rebellion?
Ooh, favorite act of rebellion. You know, I think although it doesn't seem like such an act of rebellion now, I love the fact that I have my own last name. And although I chose to get married and I married a cisgender man and all of those things, and you know, that I definitely think that the fact that I have my own name, that my own intellectual property is related to that name, that the history of that name even being the name of like a slave owner who owned my family has its own fraught history, but really has made it important to me to kind of maintain the name I was born with and keep it and not feel like my name had to be associated with another man or a man's family. And so it's not that I judge anyone else who has that, but for me, I feel a sense of strength that I may be in partnership and relationship to this other person, but I was born Jamia Wilson, and that's how I will continue to be as long as I'm alive. And I feel good about that.
I really appreciate you sharing that perspective. I think that's really valuable, and it's not one that we get to hear a lot. And yeah, that's really cool.
Thank you so much. It's really interesting. I had some people ask me, like, when I got married, like, why I didn't change my name, or get really surprised when I corrected them when they started calling me by my husband's last name. Or even when my mother passed away, some of the obituary people wrote that I had my husband's last name and I asked them to change it. People were really surprised, but I said, no, that's not my name.
Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting because it still kind of evokes responses from people. And I find that interesting, but it never made sense to me why I should change my name if my husband isn't changing his. And so.
Yeah, I've had similar thoughts to that too. Not that I'm married, but like, I'm just like, that's crossed my mind. So it's cool hearing you share that perspective.
And if you have that thought, I mean, it's really interesting because long before I was married, I kind of had a sense of it.
Really?
I always talk about that with partners to be like, what would you think about this?
And, yeah. You know, yeah.
Kind of be a litmus test.
Totally. I've done that. Yeah.
Because I was open to combining names, but I wasn't going to lose my name.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that funny? Oh my gosh. I love that, you know, and like it is. It's just talking about like whatever we want is okay. We can break the rules about what it means to be a woman and create our own. Okay. What is exciting you right now? What is super inspiring to you or motivating you?
I'm just really excited about how these presidential the conversations, the debates, which are stressful in their own sense, are driving people who may not have been as politically aware last time around to be more engaged. And that I'm hearing more conversation about policy and the issues than I remember in past years. And so I'm really excited about, there's just an increased awareness about civic education right now. And I'm feeling good about that.
Me too. And what is next for you?
I have a book coming out in October. That's a children's book called The ABCs of AOC.
Hey.
Book, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And it's available now for pre-order, but it won't be out until October. And then I have another children's book coming out next February, and it's called Big Ideas for Young Thinkers. And it's all like philosophy and thinking and, you know, what kind of big ideas about the big questions that young people might be asking, and answers from the traditional philosophers they might be used to hearing from, but also people whose voices might not have been heard yet on these issues. And so I'm really excited about that as well. And it answers questions like, why do we love? Why do we exist? What happens when we die?
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. The big questions. Yes. Beautiful. And I want to know, since I've heard you talk before about the little whispers and listening to them, the little whispers in your mind that a lot of times we ignore because we're too afraid to act on them or to listen to them. So I want to know, what was the scariest little whisper that you ever responded to?
Ooh, there's so many. I feel like I'm always responding to them, but I think every time I take on a project that scares me, a new book, or I think, you know, there's just been a couple of big, when the Women's March team asked me to write their oral history with a sort of impossible deadline, knowing it would be a big project that would have a big, important historic import, the little whisper was like, this is scary, but hell yes, you should do it. You got this. And I thought, no, I don't got this. It's going to be so much in such little time, but I did it and it happened.
Cool. Well, where can people find you?
People can find me at my website, www.jamiawilson.org, JamiaWilson.org. They can also find me on Twitter at JamiaW or on Instagram at Jamia A. Wilson.
Okay. And can you spell the Instagram handle out just so people can find you?
Yeah, sure. Jamia, JamiaWilson.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for being here and talking about all this important stuff.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, and congratulations on launching and answering.
Thank you so much. And if you guys enjoyed listening to this, please leave a review on iTunes.